Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRue Show. It's Saturday, May 9th, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is Kill Globalization to Combat the Flu Pandemic Threats. With us today to discuss this, I'm very glad to say we have someone in Mexico. She's actually in transit right now by cell phone. I'm very glad that Ingrid Torres can be with us. Welcome, Ingrid.
Hello, Marcia. Thank you.
And here in the studio, we have Chris Craig from 21st Century Science and Technology. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Marcia.
And Cynthia Rush from EIR, who's on the Ibero-America desk and a longtime activist in the fight here. Welcome, Cynthia.
Hi.
Now, I'll say just this, that in the battle front, we have an important piece of ammunition, where on April 28th, just at the time this influenza outbreak was escalating, Mr. LaRouche gave an international strategic webcast and on the LaRouche Political Action Committee site called "The Next Shoe Will Drop." He discussed this fact that globalization is creating the conditions for epidemics, literally. And "The Next Shoe Will Drop," I'm glad to say, we now have out, as we just printed 125,000 copies, that is the LaRouche Political Action Committee, for mass circulation. It's being shipped around the country. It's 40 pages. It's need to know, not just on this, but on the critical leadership question, especially in Washington, D.C., where what you have is fracturing of the Obama administration. You have, that's not our topic for today, but you've had these wild men, behavioral economists, going wild in terms of Nazi medicine, in terms of foreign policy. Larry Summers, leading the pack, just intervened on policy for Israel and Palestine this past week. In other words, that's how crazy it is. That's how much Mr. Obama is letting this happen. So we have, this is very important. I recommend everyone go on to LaRouchePack.com to see what Mr. LaRouche said April 28th, but also financially and otherwise back this effort. And really what we've got is declaring war on Nazi medicine and the takedown of public health and food supply and everything under the 40 years of globalization. So leading the charge in Mexico being the epicenter of the current influenza outbreak, we've had the International LaRouche Youth Movement. Ingrid Torres is key in all of this, and they've had an international webcast just May 7th. They issued a statement May 4th. And Ingrid, I know your statement was the influenza virus was incubated 27 years ago. That would be 1982. What is the situation in Mexico, please?
Well, basically, the country was put in an emergency situation where classes were interrupted as people knew from the news. And the whole country or mainly the capital was paralyzed by this situation, which is combined not just to, you know, a service economy where people were not able to work, but also to the ongoing collapse of the whole financial system internationally. So the situation was a little bit critical in the sense also for the economy. But this has been a whole process that we talked about, as you said, in the leaflet, where the Mexican economy has been destroyed through globalization, through lack of investment in infrastructure that was done with López Portillo before 82, where we created major hospitals like the Hospital La Raza, which is one of the main hospitals of specialties in medicine of high technology for, you know, public health in the nation. And people all around the nation travel, for instance, from the south of Mexico, from a state called Oaxaca, which is a very, very poor state. People from there who are sick, they travel all the way to the capital just to receive medical services from here, because this is where we have, you know, a little bit of more infrastructure. But you can imagine that in a situation where this, you know, is not put under control, there will be no type of resources to control it in states where, you know, there is a whole lack of all type of infrastructure, not just health one. But yeah, I would like to just emphasize that the big danger of this epidemic is the combination of this with the collapse of the whole financial system.
Right, and to go to your point more about a kind of picture of then and then now, because you raised this issue of what the president of Mexico was doing at that time, José López Portillo, and your and the economic condition, you had other things very relevant to resisting the effects of flu, like nutrition. What about that? I mean, the food supply.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, for instance, Mexico was self-sufficient in food production, like basic food, you know, like corn, beans, rice, things that are, well, common for every Mexican in 1982, where we're self-sufficient on that type of production, which through the GATT and the NAFTA treaty has been totally destroyed, and now we're put into the conditions where, you know, we're importing food from all over around the world, for instance, corn from China. And this makes the situation very complicated because, as it was known with this swine flu, there was one Canadian person working in a transnational that is set up here in Mexico, and he, through the contact with the pig, he got infected, he went back to Canada, and now, you know, you have this potential also there in Canada of having this type of epidemic. So, yeah, globalization is not helping at all because people work in Mexico because it's cheap and then they go back to other nations or, you know, other Mexicans that are outside and come back to Mexico and they have to go back again to the U.S., for example. And it's very hard to keep control of a situation like this when you have all this labor going back and forth to different nations looking for a decent job.
Right. We can interpose here that a hallmark of globalization, you mentioned these transnational big livestock operations where they have migrant labor come to work as work teams. A name that comes up is Smithfield Holdings and Smithfield Foods, because it's the biggest pork processor in the world. It's the biggest in the United States, and it specializes in these gigantic operations, for example, in North Carolina. But they produce 20% of all the hogs in the United States, and then they set up two big, huge operations, or they work through two big companies in Mexico, Veracruz, I think, and also maybe Oaxaca. But Alberta, Canada, is the place you mentioned where a traveler from Mexico has come and infected the pigs there. So this has been the characteristic of the last 30 years, not an exception to the rule, and what we should shut down yesterday. Do you want to say, apart from the... There's also been tremendous amount of exporting of food from Mexico elsewhere. I'm not talking about the food safety danger, but the use of scarce Mexican water, right, to produce frozen vegetables and other things in the north. Is that right?
Yeah, as we were saying before, just this whole process of deindustrialization after the presidency of López Portillo has left us with a situation where in the middle of this epidemic, you know, there are still right now cities here in the capital who don't have, they don't have water. And one of the main recommendations that the health institutions are doing to Mexicans is that you have to wash your hands, you know, every hour or every 2 hours, something like that. But you can imagine that, you know, the country having a lack of water nationally, especially in the north, but it's also a very, very big problem here in the center part of Mexico. that is also combined with the other effect that I also want to mention with this, what you were saying before of the food production, that not just this traveling back and forth, which is crazy, but also the situation of people here not being able to buy foods that are, or main things that are becoming more and more expensive to buy. The lack of water is really a big conflict, and that's why we're fighting for these cleaner projects that people can see a video on the website that is called like the Nahuapa Plino. But it will be a way, an initial step for a way out, not just from the swine flu, but for, you know, the whole process of globalization, poverty, getting the nation out of the type of risk that poverty puts you in when it's combined with all these type of sicknesses.
Right, and one more thing on these vulnerabilities. Part of globalization, as pushed by George Soros and these big international financial London-centered, really, operatives, is narcotics. And you've been waging a big fight. What's the latest on the drug question in Mexico, and especially, we heard that your Congress approved drug legalization?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's really like hitting almost like dark age in a full picture because, yeah, as you said, the Congress was shown its corruption, legalizing a small percentage of all types of drugs.
Oh.
Now the thing is that this whole epidemic was used as a way of passing this law through in very few days. I mean, it was almost like 3 days where all this thing was passed through in the Congress. And, it shows their corruption because we have been fighting for things for the Pleno, which are standing in the Congress, in the federal Congress. It has a budget, but they're still discussing it. And then you have these laws like legalizing drugs, which are passed in less than a week, you know, in the middle of all these crises of the swine flu. So for us, it was very clear when we intervened at the forum made in the National Congress a couple of weeks ago, where there was supposed to be a discussion of legalization of drugs and, you know, pros and things in pro and contra of legalizing drugs. But it was clear for us when we talked to most of these panelists that were in favor of legalizing drugs that it's really George Soros' hands and money, narcotraffic money behind all of this. Because most of them admitted to work for different foundations that are linked to Soros' Drug Policy Alliance or Open Society. So these people, some of them were very angry because we distributed a leaflet that was called George Soros and Nathelman are prostitutes of the British Empire. So you can imagine if that's your boss, you know, how are you going to react to type of leaflet like that? So we were very surprised because all of these panelists were so, you know, angry at us, saying, why are you saying that about Soros? He's my boss. You know, he's not a Nazi. Why are you saying he's a Nazi? And so it was very clear by the reaction, and they saying openly that, you know, Soros was their boss. This whole thing that is being put through to a couple of small parties, you know, very small, insignificant parties in Mexico that are pushing for legalizing drugs, that it was not their fight, but it was Soros' money that in the middle of this collapse, with the corruption of these type of politicians that want money, and that the money out there, you know, the big money is coming right now from narco traffic, that's the reason why they're legalizing drugs. So we're really in the situation where we're just telling people, look, this is clearly the British Empire, wherever you see it, you know, in the plans for reduction of population with the swine flu, combined with legalization of drugs being pushed by one of, you know, of the administrators of the Queen Elizabeth's money, George Soros, that he's pushing to this of legalizing drugs, that it's everywhere where you see it in the NAFTA treaty policy, you know, free trade, it's all really the policy of an empire to end up with the sovereignty of nations and reduce populations that are very vulnerable to these type of things. And as LaRouche has stated, you know, if you really want to make a condition for an epidemic, you legalize drugs and that will kill the immunological, the defense system of the population. If people are become drug addicts, that will make them even more vulnerable to all type of sicknesses.
Right. Well, go ahead.
Oh, no, so I was just going to say, so we really need to destroy the empire. We have no other exit out of this.
Right, they're the ones with the... They're the source of the microbes. Let me ask you one thing. You haven't been able to, for some time, you couldn't have social meetings, you couldn't have gatherings. It was unwise at the beginning, also, especially knowing what to try and figure out what you're dealing with. But still, you've had reactions of your networks of activists, people around the country. What's that been like during this time period?
Well, the big gatherings are still forbidden until the 15th of May.
Okay.
So any big gathering, concerts, that's still stopped. You know, cinemas, all these types of activities. But yeah, one of the things is that there was a whole campaign, especially among the youth, more than in any other sector, to deny this crisis. And, you know, I personally was very shocked because, you know, LaRouche has been talking and forecasting that a collapse of the financial system would lead to a dark age with sicknesses and all of this. And so you think that people will actually react to reality and say, oh, my God, you know, now it's a collapse. Now we have the swine flu. And that they will somehow relate that. But I was fairly surprised when I noticed that that was not true, that actually a lot of these youth who are in their virtual life of MySpace, Twitter, Facebook, what these youth start spreading out in the whole internet, and you know, we in the movement, we receive tons of these type of emails, is that the swine flu was a lie created from the government. That the government had created this to distract the population from the collapse of the economy. And it was sort of ironical that it was not clear that it was the same type of thing, you know, the collapse of the economy and sicknesses. And so we made this leaflet that you talked about, making the point clear that it's when you see economy in a physical way and not just understand it as the collapse of money per se, but that it's actually the collapse of the physical conditions of a society, with the infrastructure, with what we were talking about on food, on water, on health infrastructure, that this is really what created the conditions for Mexico to be in, you know, in the epicenter of this whole thing. That we still don't know exactly the origin of these swine flu, mm-hmm. But we do know that people have died in Mexico, and more than in the U.S., for example, because of the collapse of the physical economy. So it was so shocking, in a sense, to see that a lot of the people right now are in a state of denial. You know, they don't want to recognize the type of crisis we're in. They're not, you know, some of them are not, or they pretend to be relaxed about it. You know, youth pretend to say, oh, yeah, that's a lie. You know, like the syndrome of I'm immortal. You know, I'm not going to die of this. And they're not, you know, taking precautions or against this type of, you know, health problems. So, yeah, we have been going into the metro, distributing this leaflet, and even though people consciously try to say, I don't believe this, because if they believe it, that will mean they have to recognize that we are in a very chaotic situation. But even though they consciously say, this is not true, this is just a lie from the government, everybody that we gave the leaflet to was reading it. Most of the people were, you know, as soon as you gave it to them, started to read it. And this is, you know, read it and finish it. So this was very, very good in that sense. Even though they try to say it's not true, they're still worried about what's going behind the scenes. And a lot of these persons that we gave these leaflets in the universities or in the metro start calling back at us to the phone of the office, and some of them assisted to these webcams that we mentioned before. But, yeah, we do need to organize the population to connect, you know, a little bit of the dots of what's going out on outside.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And it's there are other age brackets and groups of the population, too, that don't want to connect it up, that it's easier to say, oh, this is separate, or this is a plot. I mean, it might be. It's possible to, we'll get to that in a minute, to make it in a lab, but you don't have to kill people. It can happen on its own and have self-feeding effects, as you mentioned, the concept of the dark age. If a lot of hogs get it in Canada or elsewhere, et cetera, et cetera, you can draw that out on your own. Everyone should know. Go ahead.
Oh, just that also what we were mentioning, people, is that we're making this comparison of physical conditions to the Dark Age, and how also the in the Dark Age there was a mutation of the, how do you call the Black Death in English? Yeah, the Black Death. But it was a mutation in that whole process that also Boccaccio describes in the Decameron. But also this other, the so-called Spaniard flu in 1918. And I don't know if Christine or somebody else is going to talk more about it, but just briefly, because this was very important just to set up reality to youth, because they really don't, see, we don't understand history at all. and people, they don't connect anything of what's going on right now historically. So we're telling them, look, in the First World War in 1918, more than 40 million people died. And the Spanish flu came in spring, but it didn't kill a lot of people. It came back afterwards, half a year later in winter, and that's when it killed, you know, these 40 million so people around the world. So that we really, even though if right now people don't see the danger as such, because maybe they don't have a sick person next to them, you know, that empirical or that, yeah, that's seeable for them, that the potential for a spread out of these type of sickness is there, just as in the First World War. But this time we have accepted the conditions of destroying our infrastructure, like in wars, but now through globalization. But this was a very important point to make them understand the type of situation we're in, the Dark Age and what happened in 1918.
Yes, go ahead.
Ingrid, it's Cynthia, I just wanted to add something here. From a historical standpoint, I think it's really important for people to know what kinds of social protection or constitutionally mandated protections existed, say, going back to the 1940s, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, in Mexico, but in many other countries throughout the Americas, which had to be eliminated and were eliminated in the process of creating the physical conditions which make it possible for an epidemic or a pandemic to spread. In Mexico, you had the National Social Security Institute that was set up in 1943 by President Ávila Camacho. And that was done specifically in accordance with Article 123 of the Mexican Constitution, which states that the government has an obligation to protect workers. It might have been somewhat limited in the beginning in terms of like protecting them from accidents or illness, or if one became a widow or a widower, and later it became more broad. But you had those types of institutions that were created throughout the Americas in Chile and Argentina and many other countries. You also had state agencies that were created regarding controlling and coordinating the marketing of food for purchase at reasonable prices for the population. In Mexico, you had CONASUPO. You had other such agencies in Argentina. You had the IAPI, which was created in 1946, which coordinated the marketing of all agricultural production, including grains, distribution, purchase of capital goods for agricultural production. It took out of the hands of the grain cartels control over all aspects of agriculture, marketing, consumption, production, distribution, etc. These types of institutions, also you had, of course, Social Security. In Chile, in the 1930s, you had a very broad system of social protection. It actually dates back to the time of Bismarck and what is called the welfare state or the benefactor state, but providing all of these kinds of social protections for the population. And, you know, from that period forward, going then into the 1980s, the late 80s, the early 90s, the process of eliminating these agencies and institutions was fundamental, you know, as part of NAFTA or even before that, saying these were an inefficient use of state funds. CONASUPO was dismantled in 1999 by Ernesto Zedillo, you know, who's now working for George Soros.
Yeah, you're right.
So, and even, you know, in places like Haiti, which today the image that you bring up in your mind of Haiti is of an absolute hellhole, total devastation, total poverty, total disease. In 1941, Haiti was just about self-sufficient in food production. Why? Because the Good Neighbor Policy under Franklin Roosevelt set up an institution. It was called the Haitian American Agricultural Development Society, SHADA, which funneled credit through the Exim Bank and from the U.S. government, but for the specific purpose of making Haiti self-sufficient in food. And saying, well, maybe this would not be a great industrial nation, but it had this capability, and it had also the capability of producing other products, you know, for export, but it could feed its population. And today you have the image of people in Haiti eating dirt cookies, you know, dirt mud mixed with grain or a little bit of grain, a little bit of corn, and people eat that. So this, you know, this historical process is really important to keep in mind in terms of what actually did exist. And it was from the standpoint, as our Constitution in the United States mandates the defense of the general welfare, this was absolutely the case in most constitutions in throughout Ibero-America. And it was on that basis, that conscious basis, that governments acted and said, this is our obligation, so we will care for our population. And you know, the process that we then saw also of privatization of Social Security, for example, in Chile and in, you know, 8 or 9 countries, including Mexico, in Ibero-America, denying people pensions or giving them some miserable small amount of money on which nobody could exist. So people continue working because they can't afford to retire. This was a conscious, deliberate destruction of what had been historically a very important protection for the population. So those things I think are important to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Do you want to say more about that, Ingrid, or no? It's just...
Well, no, just, yeah, just to, yeah, to be the...
It seems we're having trouble with cutting out on the line. Keep talking, or we'll try a little longer. Go ahead.
Oh. Okay. So just that the destruction of the
You might be at a tricky place where the coverage is cutting out. I think George in our control room might double check it with you. Let me just do this while we're all still live. Do you want to try one more time, Ingrid? And otherwise, we might go to the virus itself and reiterate a couple of points of how nature is taking advantage. Nature is neutral. It's mankind that runs it. But she might say something about the virus while we get the technical matter cleared up. Do you want to try one more time, Ingrid? These are iffy when it comes to cell phones. Sometimes they click right back in. Go ahead. We can hear you, yes.
Now?
It might be. Keep going.
Okay. To say that, it's very important. How the institutions that provided and that regulated prices for totally destroyed through globalization. So the root is not. The intention of reducing the population has been there since the whole free trade policy started. So, yeah, that's all.
Right. We got pretty much 90% of that, and you're quite right to reiterate that there had, instead of regulated prices or organized protection of agriculture, industry, energy, infrastructure, transportation, the taking of this down is part of reducing the population of the whole world, the classic imperial policy. It's deliberate, and that's what we're seeing. So then, bingo, what happens when the microbe takes advantage of this? Chris, what are we talking about with the influenza virus itself, the nature of the influenza virus?
Well, the influenza virus is a virus that is well situated to take advantage of these globalization situations that you've been talking about. The virus is very changeable. It has not just one long strand of DNA like many organisms do. It has 8 ribonucleic acid or RNA strands, which are genes, which allow this virus to come into an organism and switch genes, little segments, with other viruses within an organism and reassort or get change their genetic information, mix it up with these other organisms, which gives it a chance to mutate or change very easily and get new abilities within the organism that can then be spread efficiently. So with these strands or genes code for the proteins which are necessary for the virus to survive and reproduce and spread from host to host. So that once you have this sort of reassortment, then you can get the opportunities for a pandemic like we see the opportunity now, if the circumstances are ready. And the way this all comes about really is that, viruses, influenza viruses really started out as waterfowl viruses that infected the guts of waterfowl and spread through the water to other waterfowl. Now, mammals have picked up these viruses because the viruses have been able to reassort, mutate, and change so that they can infect the watery respiratory systems of mammals. And they have evolved to be able to spread not through water of lakes to other organisms, but through droplets of water spread from people sneezing and coughing or on their hands to other mammals. And the pig is a mammal that is somewhat like a bird and somewhat like a human being in its respiratory tissues. And so it is a very good mixing bowl for such viruses. And that is why people are focused on the pig as having incubated to some extent this sort of a virus. This virus is a swine virus. It, in every aspect, it looks like a swine virus that has been circulating since 1998. It's the only difference it has from normal swine viruses that have been circulating since 1998 is it has 2 genes that have come from a Eurasian sort of a swine, and we don't know how or when that happened. Now, those two genes make this a novel organism that is not circulating in swine presently in North America. We don't know the origin of this one. We don't know when it came out to be this. It's under intense investigation, so we just can't say that it happened at this pig farm or in that. It happened in Mexico or Canada or whatever. We don't know. But we do know that this organism has the ability to spread fast from human to human. So it's not just a swine virus anymore. It doesn't need swine. In fact, it can spread from human to human and go back to swine and then incubate and change some more. Now that is a scary virus. And if we end up having a situation where this virus can become infective enough to be somewhat like the Spanish flu of 1918, we could have one-third of the population of the world infected with this virus. And if it had even just a 1% kill rate, that would mean 20 million people dead in the world. And that would mean, say, 1 million people dead in the United States. Now, a normal flu virus has much less than 1% kill and would only kill in the United States 36,000 people. If you had a 0.5% kill rate, that would be 500,000 Americans killed. So you're talking if we get a pandemic ability in this virus, say, as it spreads around through the south in their winter months and comes back in our fall months, we could have a devastation, even if this was not a particularly lethal virus as far as one person is concerned. It could cause a lot of deaths and economic havoc, and it's, so to speak, nothing to sneeze about.
Let me ask you one thing, and you were talking about the family tree of this Eurasian swine connection,
yes.
And then it is said there's also an identifiable avian connection, bird connection in its genetic
yes.
makeup of the current new H1N1?
Yes, but that's not new. That's part of the makeup that moved in. The original swine virus in the United States was really came about due to the Spanish influenza of 1918. And it's been hypothesized recently that it went from humans to swine and became the dominant swine flu until just recently, in 1998, when a new sort of a swine flu spread throughout the swine population, replacing the other one. And that one had qualities of the avian influenza and human influenza in several of its genes. So it's not, that part isn't new. It's 10 years old, and it's now part of the swine flu. Just like now, our human flu we're calling the swine flu, now it's a human flu, but not before it started just recently. It was a swine flu. Now it's a human flu, but it's got swine parts. The other one was a swine flu that had avian and human parts that it acquired 10 years ago.
So there's a lot of branches on the family tree.
There are a lot of branches on the family tree.
And just for people to know, we maybe in the near future we'll have more on this, but in animal husbandry terms, it is the case that over the 40s, 50s, 60s, I think it was known in the 1930s, you could identify and type the swine flu, say in North American hogs.
Right.
And so anyone, a farmer and so forth, raising them would listen, and if his hogs were coughing, and you could medicate them. It didn't have to be that dangerous. And you would... it was familiar. It was something you were trained to do or knew how to do and took care of your animals, as you would with any meat animal or your pet. I say this, I just want to take one email that came in just before the show started. And it's from Adam. And he was asking about livestock and protein farming, you know, meat farming, that as we move forward to a new renaissance, he said, and do the opposite of what has just been described by Ingrid and Cynthia and Chris. If we took measures to increase the potential relative population density in the U.S. and Mexico and elsewhere around the world, what would the farming look like? What would be the distribution of these livestock farms throughout the landmass in order to prohibit the types of epidemics associated with what we have in our hands now, this so-called swine flu. He also is referring, I'll let people know, if you want to look at 21st Century Science and Technology magazine, it's online, and there is a, there was an article that discussed concentrated high technology raising of sheep. You could see them, they were in something like a geodesic dome. And how could we cultivate this for continued population growth without, you know, creating problems? He said, I presume we will have defeated the oligarchy and be able to do this fast. But it's a nice thing to look at. Let me say something first, and then Cynthia, who especially follows Argentina, which is a kind of big example mm-hmm. of what we're talking about of, on the good side and bad side, what happened there. But one thing is, it is the case that on the different continents of the world and the and the different cultural dietary preferences that obtain. You know, some places sheep is what's eaten and no one eats pork. Other places in India, you're not going to eat the cows, but you could drink the milk. In other words, you have the different preferences around the world. And if it's true, you did not have this dark age monetary succubus around the world destroying everything. The one thing that lessens the threat of disease is that when you have family-scale farm operations all across your landscape and highly delineated towns with good infrastructure for both of them, transportation and everything, if you do get an outbreak of something in your chickens or pigs or cattle in some part of your nation or your continent, it's automatically sort of localized and regionalized. You have the potential for containing it or mitigating its spread. You don't have the laborers coming in, flying all over the place. You don't have the animals being shipped all over the place. You might ship some seed stock, do it under very good conditions, bring in some good breeding animals. But as it is now, you have created these mega operations, huge dairy farms in California. Now they're going bankrupt because the U.S. government won't intervene to put a floor price under the milk as the financial collapse takes place. So you do have a natural protection system where you can have hygienic measures, and if you do get an outbreak, it doesn't automatically crossfeed and have wonderful conditions to mutate. Would you say that's accurate, Chris?
I think so. I think that that you need to have some kind of complexity involved to separate animals from other animals so that you don't have a continual spreading of large amounts of virus across the state and across the nation lines all the time.
And the thing is I just refer people to Mr. LaRouche, who in recent years commissioned different articles and interventions. Do you know where your food comes from? We shouldn't have monoculture of crops either. We're talking about animal viruses. But you've got botanical diseases. You have a new terrible wheat rust that's come in East Africa and spread over into Iran. It's called UG99. It was found in Uganda in 1999. So, Cynthia, in terms of the whole soy monoculture in South America, or anything else, would you say about this?
Well, I could say something about the Argentine case. In soy generally, we've seen a huge expansion in countries which, such as Argentina or Brazil, Paraguay, who Argentina, of course, is known for its wheat production, but also has historically had very varied agriculture, very nutritious diet, Brazil, wheat, beef as well. In the last 10, 12 years or so in Argentina, you've had an absolutely unbridled expansion of soy monoculture, encouraged by people such as George Soros and others, you know, speculators, hedge funds.
And also Cargill or Jack
Cargill,
Daniels,
as well maybe. As the cartels. And it's really quite astonishing. Of course, 10 years ago, you had a total of about 26.5 million hectares dedicated to agriculture. A hectare is 2.4 acres. And of that amount, there are less than 5 million hectares used for soy cultivation. Move forward 10 years. Today, you've got a little over 30 million hectares for agriculture. And of that, 16.5 hectares are now dedicated to soy production. They've moved into areas that traditionally were used for rice production or vegetables, produce, and have displaced them, in addition to causing all sorts of ecological problems, deforestation, chopping down trees, etc. And this was only 2% of that production is consumed domestically. So 98% of that is exported to China, to other places. And it's absolutely insane. And it's reached the point now where they're trying to incorporate soy into the diet of the population. Soy milk, soy this, soy that, you know, which is not part of their traditional diet, and displacing other nutritious foods. So this is really nuts. I think now Argentina is either the third or the fourth largest soy exporter in the world, for no good reason other than, you know, meeting demand, China's demand, which was significant, but which is now dropping. And you had this wild speculation on soy, the soy price, as well as other commodities, which now that prices have started declining, that's created a real problem. So it's a perfect example of lunacy, globalization.
Right. Staying on this one aspect of the food supply, economics, and nutrition, I wonder, Ingrid, are you still with us? George in the control room. I don't know if you can bring Ingrid back with us by phone. Yes, Ingrid, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. Because one thing in Mexico, I understand it's something like 20 million people now are literally in the category of the hungry, not enough food. I mean, it just isn't there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, officially we have that sector of the population hungry and 60 million, which is almost 60% of the population.
Now,
So this is the sector of the population which is mainly vulnerable to this type of situation.
We have, in the remaining quarter hour, I also want anyone here to get in the points before we have to close about this whole situation, whether the science, the dark age threat, but also the mobilizing to fight to end globalization. But one thing I wanted to ask you, you also have tremendous amounts of displaced persons, period, because of the financial collapse, and they were in jobs that were no good. They had to leave their countries or their states of Mexico. They had to go to North America. To the United States. They had to go north. Now they're... Would you say something about the dimensions of that, Ingrid?
Well, one of the main crises that hit here with this whole emergency situation where, you know, schools were closed. Now they have just reopened 2 days ago where restaurants were closed. All these public gatherings. What was very clear was that all of our economy is based on services. So all these people were really in a crisis, not just because of the financial collapse, but also added to this type of emergency situation. Where, you know, now they have reopened with certain measures, but it's clear that it had to be done because of the economic situation that was not sustainable for them, not because the health situation is all under control. But we have more or less exported 30 million Mexicans to the U.S., mainly people from the agriculture sector, which has been the one destroyed through NAFTA treating. So all these people, you know, could be here. We have projects like the Plino project, where we could have decent employment, where we could go back to be self-sufficient. And now being the perfect occasion, because it's more and more clear, even to the U.S. government circles, that, you know, this system is totally bankrupt. and we do want to avoid an epidemic around the world, we would just not need these type of measures, you know, closing or not having any big gatherings or health measures. But we do need to increase our infrastructure.
Could I just add one thing? I think it's important to remember that just 1 year ago, literally in April of 2008, April and May, we saw around the world and in the Americas as well, food riots, Haiti, Central America, but various other countries in the world. And there were a number of emergency meetings of Central American agro ministers devising emergency programs to increase food production, to get financing for food. And some decisions were made that this is what they were going to do. However, and this was in the context of rising food prices, which put food out of reach of most of the populations. A year later, nothing has changed. In fact, food prices are higher today, and certainly in Central America, than they were a year ago. And Helga Zeplerush, of course, issued her call for doubling food production internationally. And we took that to the FAO meeting, I believe, in Rome. One thing on Mexico, I believe a figure given for the number of displaced farmers displaced by NAFTA, that is forced out of production, is 2 million, and that may be an underestimate. But what we have seen across Central America is similar process. As protective tariffs were eliminated in the name of free trade, farmers were just pushed out of food production altogether. So countries like Guatemala that had 10 years ago was self-sufficient in food production is no longer. And of course, then you have the phenomenon that we've looked at with production of things like sugarcane or African palm oil
for biofuels,
which is huge projects in which Cargill is also involved in Guatemala. And they've just driven people out of food production because sugarcane or the African palm oil apparently doesn't require as many workers. So then you drive people out of food production into the slums in the city where there are no jobs, and certainly nutrition is, you know, not available. So that's a process that's taking place across Central America, where half of 44 million people in Central America alone, half are chronically malnourished. You know, which is people in that, under those conditions, are have no ability to resist disease of any kind.
Yeah, are you there, Ingrid? Still, I think so.
Yes, I'm here.
I just wanted to. We can continue with Cynthia's description because we're discussing today, of course, the influenza pandemic in terms of how globalization's responsible for it. But also there are other diseases, especially in the Caribbean, dengue fever,
yes,
and so forth. But Ingrid, before we have to close, do you want to say anything about looking ahead or what your plans are as part of the International LaRouche Youth Movement in Mexico or throughout Ibero-America? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that our task is to really make the population, to make them clear what the real threats are immediately. Because it is clear that, you know, this influenza crisis, as I was saying before, this is still not, for people, it's still clear that it's the same situation of the collapse of the physical economy. And so that we need to make them identify what's the real enemy, what's the real threat against them and their family. And also that to the institutions, like the Congress, and you know, to have things like the Plino Project, which is one of our main things nationally here in Mexico coming into these next months, with the video that we have produced, but also just mobilizing this even more, so we can have it done in the next period of time. And this also, you know, will go for institutions for the U.S. because we will need cooperation, not just between the U.S. and Mexico against the narco traffic, but against things also like the influenza. There will be no type of exit of this type of crisis if we don't cooperate with the U.S. So also President Obama you know, needs to be organized to make a difference between what's the real threat, what's reality, and what's fantasy. Not allow people to go into, you know, MySpace type of worldview or Twitter type of worldview, but actually to make a more historical analysis. And also, yeah, I would just say that what comes in the next month is that we will need the cooperation between our nations.
Right, thank you. And I want to reiterate to people that this video that Ingrid just mentioned about Plino, the Northwest Mexico hydraulic project that's been on the shelf. It's been planned since the 1960s, I believe. And there's a counterpart to bring water from the eastern side slopes of Mexico northward as well. And this fits in with the continental scale project called North American Water and Power Alliance that originated out in California that was before the U.S. Congress in the 1960s. So it really is a question of changing people's or engaging in people to change their identities and see where they are in history and do this or else. You can see this video you can find it on LaRouchePac.com, LaRouchePac.com. You can go to the Spanish language section. You can go otherwise there. And you also, in EIR Online, this coming week, will be able to have this statement that the Mexican LaRouche Youth Movement released May 4th, I think, that was titled, "The Influenza Virus Was Incubated 27 Years Ago." And so that's on the EIR Online news site in a couple days. And I think with that, I let me just turn to Cynthia again here on the picture for, if you want to underscore the dark age side, I don't want to end on a bad note, but you mentioned the food riots and and the disease vectoring. This is all getting that much worse. There are, however, even if it's rear guard, major fights in Argentina, right, and elsewhere throughout the whole continent that the International LaRouche Youth Movement is very involved. Could you identify some of those battle lines?
Well, in Argentina, over the past year in particular, the government has had sort of a rear guard action, but nonetheless establishing certain criteria for food sovereignty, that is, imposing taxes on soybean exports, for example, which provoked total hysteria from British financial interests, and making sure that high inflationary prices for those food products were not transferred to the domestic scene so that people could buy food at a reasonable price. And there's been an ongoing battle there, combined with a fight against efforts to legalize the drug trade, or rather drug consumption for personal use, which the government unfortunately is backing. So it's sort of a two-pronged effort there. And Argentina historically, of course, has had taken on the drug cartels going back 60 years. I mean, the grain cartels. And, you know, it's had a concept of food sovereignty, which was never much to the liking of the British oligarchy. So that's a very important battleground.
Right. And otherwise, in Chile or elsewhere?
On the food front, well...
Any of the fronts.
Yeah, it's, all of these countries are just suffering under the effects of globalization and unable to produce food that they have a capability for producing. So you're getting, unfortunately, it tends to be somewhat isolated in places where you get farmers revolting or, you know, they don't have a total programmatic focus. But, and certainly, you know, we've indicated ourselves and documented the destruction of Social Security and everything else that goes along with maintaining living standards. So, and things, I think, are coming to a head generally where you're getting nations, even if they've been devoted to free trade, taking certain protectionist measures just from the standpoint of, you know...
Live or die.
Yeah. So Brazil, for example, stopped exporting wheat for a time. So did Argentina. So did other countries. Because they had to feed their population, and you know, that was what they decided to do. So,
right. Well, I think this is the last final, this is ending our hour, which is May 9th, 2009, on our topic, Kill Globalization to Combat the Flu Pandemic Threats. So, Ingrid, I want to thank you very much for, are you still there participating en route from Mexico City outward, right?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Martha.
And we wish you very good luck in your battlefront there, and we will do everything here. And thank you to Chris Craig. Thank you, Cynthia Rush. And so this will be the end of the May 9th LaRouche Show. We're weekly from 3 to 4 Eastern Time on www.larouchepub.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.